guardian of the universe, simply to get the forces of evil. The powers of this man,
expectable. Oh, the brain.
Complete tall buildings and up in the sky.
Is it a bird?
Is it a plane?
A mailman by day.
Cities, guardian by night.
Defending the citizens of New York.
For centuries, the world has been protected by a group of extraordinary men and women who have dedicated themselves to fighting crime. World's mightiest mortal.
He has powers far beyond the capabilities of the Earth.
Look up in the sky. It's a bird. It's a plane. No, it's a duck.
Welcome to the Marvel Miscellaneous Rejects, the beginning of Percolated Media's look at the entire Marvel Cinematic Universe.
If you consider it, Kick-Ass, we'd be honored to have you join us.
Join Garrett.
Every duck's got his limit. And you scum have pushed me over the line.
Matt.
I'd appreciate it enormously if you could just leave us in peace until I finish this lovely pint of Guinness.
And Adam.
What I don't know is, what the hell I'm doing here?
As they start their comic book movie dive by reviewing the misfits of the Marvel movies.
You don't scare me with that hocus pocus, boy.
Included in this part of the Marvel retrospective is Howard the Duck.
It's Howard, thank you.
Dr. Mordred.
I thought you'd never get back. This guy says he's on a mission from his master to kill you.
His master's dead.
Man-Thing.
I guess they didn't fill you in all the way.
The Kick-Ass films.
Just because you dress like us doesn't mean that you can be like one of us.
Big Hero 6.
Hello, I am Baymax, your personal healthcare companion.
And the Kingsman movies.
You break the law, you pay the price.
Be sure to keep checking the site, as the boys will, from time to time, come back to continue going through the entire slate of Marvel movies up until they catch up on the MCU proper.
Thanks for not giving up on me.
So sit down and open up your favorite Marvel comic, Percolated Media listeners.
And get the cover of Life Magazine, man! Life Magazine? Life Magazine went out of business, you fucking idiot!
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast, Marvel Retrospective, begins now.
Are we going to stand around here all day? Or are we going to fight?
Kingsman: The Golden Circle, released September 20th here in the U.S., 2017, budget of $105 million with a box office take of $410, and this was directed once again by Matthew Vaughn. Well, unlike Kick-Ass 2, Matthew Vaughn didn't hand this off to somebody else. He returned to the director's chair for a sequel.
Yes, he did, and I didn't know too much about this. In fact, almost nothing, but I do remember Vaughn doing a little bit of press for it. In an interview I read with him, he said that him and Millar learned from their mistakes of Kick-Ass 2, and that Vaughn kind of told the director that he just kind of handed it off saying, just do it your best in my style. And they said they weren't going to do that anymore. So here we are. Vaughn is back. We have his vision. We have another Kingsman film. And, you know, after last week, which I gave a pretty good score to, I was looking forward to what I was going to see. Because, again, this was a first-time watch for me. And for this podcast, I watched it twice.
Well, you answered part one of my question, because I knew this was a first-time watch. Was the fact that you were watching this in as close proximity as you were adding to the anticipation?
It was, yeah. I was legitimately looking forward to what he would come up with next, especially after remembering, again, that he said that he had learned from Kick-Ass 2, and his list of favorite sequels is not unlike anybody else's. You know, his favorites are Empire Strikes Back. He loves Godfather 2. He's coming back, and he's trying to do it his best in those styles of films, and I like that attitude. This is a guy who came from our generation, so I was looking forward to what I was seeing.
Sidebar, we need to stop the discourse of favorite sequels and jettison saying Godfather 2, The Dark Knight, Empire, Aliens. We need to stop saying the ones that everyone else agrees with. I'm more interested in what are the ones that you like that other people don't seem to. Well, Adam, you also had to wait, unlike Garrett, who could wait a week to watch these, or even a day. You had to wait the 2.5 years like I did. So what were you thinking when this was gearing up?
I did, and I was quite excited because I didn't see Kingsman until I saw it at home, and I was like, oh, man, this is good. And then when I heard there was going to be more, I was quite excited. I mean, this is one where I was looking forward to the theater. I was glad Matthew Vaughn was coming back because I think at this point, I think it was his first sequel and something that he had done himself. I was a big fan of X-Men First Class. I resent, and I still to some point resent, Days of Future Past because I felt like the franchise was stolen from somebody who just reinvigorated it and gave it life. So I was excited to see what somebody was going to make out of his own universe where he got to call the shots. And I hadn't seen Kick-Ass or Kick-Ass 2 when this was coming out. So yeah, I was quite excited. Happy to see it in a movie theater. It was a solo watch because my wife hadn't seen Kingsman and didn't really have a desire to see this one. Not her bag. But as a Bond fan, as an action fan, and as a Vaughn fan, yeah, I was jazzed.
I was anticipating it as well from the moment it was announced. I mean, we'll talk about the marketing in a little bit, but I thought this warranted a sequel much more than even Kick-Ass because they created such a big canvas for them to expand upon. Now that you've got the quote-unquote origin story out of the way with your main character and you've established the world, now you can really, as Richard Donner would say, play in the sandbox. But Vaughn actually questioned whether he was going to come back and direct this because he openly said he wanted to do a Flash Gordon movie around this time.
Who the hell wants to do a Flash Gordon movie?
I swear that's one of those titles that everybody says they want to do and it's never getting made.
Yeah.
Because nobody's going to front the money to budget something like that, that you have a huge risk. And it's a very cult is being kind.
Yeah.
That's a right to split by like four different entities at this point as well.
I legit challenge anybody to get through that. It is a horrible peek behind the curtain. It's terrible. When we were getting ready for Star Wars, I actually, because Lucas did cite that as something that inspired him to do Star Wars. So I tried watching it. I couldn't get an hour in. It is awful.
Matt, you know what to do. We're figuring it out somewhere.
Well, once we do He-Man, we'll loop it in with that because I feel like they're kind of spirited companion pieces in a lot of way.
We get Hawkman, we get the Pain Box. Oh, there's so much to that movie.
There is. And Vaughn said, all right, I'm going to do it. I'm going to co-write the script again. Mark Millar said he was going to be involved, although it sounds like he wasn't as in tune with this as he was with the original because they weren't really adapting. Unlike Kick-Ass 2, which did draw from some comics at the time, this was very much its own creation. But it was supposed to come out a little bit sooner than it did, but Taron Egerton decided that Robin Hood was going to be a good investment, and they had to wait for him to finish shooting that. And I feel bad for him because that movie is awful.
It's terrible.
Through no fault of his own. And it's got an interesting cast. It was like him, it was Ben Mendelsohn, it was Jamie Foxx, but it was like a Guy Ritchie wannabe in a lot of ways, which I don't understand doing with Robin Hood, especially because the Ridley Scott movie bombed too.
That not a Guy Ritchie movie?
No, that was done by, it's almost like, it's basically an imitator of his stuff.
I am not being glib. I honestly thought that was one of his movies.
He did King Arthur. That's the one you're thinking of.
Oh, yeah, yeah. When I saw everything about that, I thought it was his.
That's what happens when you finally get a movie star. You know you've made it when you star in a big bomb on a public domain property. So you got a taste of Hollywood real quick, and then he said, yep, my schedule's clear, let's do it. And then they started to really, the first one had Sam Jackson, who was a big get to a degree, but by the same token, as I said on the last show, he'll say yes to almost anything. If you look at his filmography. This one, they got a lot of pretty big names. I mean, Julianne Moore is the villain, that's a big get. Halle Berry, a former Bond girl, an Oscar winner. Jeff Bridges, another Oscar winner. Channing Tatum was a bigger star because he proven he could actually act and do more than just, you know, look good with his shirt off.
Well, they kind of got him.
Well, yeah, they got him for 2 days based on this movie. And I thought, okay, this is some pretty big star power. But I didn't like in the marketing that they let it be publicly known that Colin Firth was coming back.
Yeah, Matthew Vaughn was pissed off at that, too. He was so angry at the marketing department for leaking that.
They leaked it twice. Yeah. It's on the teaser poster. And then it's the last scene in the first trailer.
Yeah, one of the things that I didn't say in my wrap-up that I meant to say of last week's film is it was nice to see the comic book film. It was officially a comic book film. Like I said last week, they cheated. They made up their own comic and they said, yeah, this is a comic and we're going to make it. But one of the things that I really responded to with it is that
that is one of the only comic book films I could think of where it was somebody's legit vision. It wasn't tampered with. It was Vaughn through and through, and Millar to a certain degree. But like Kick-Ass, I think we had more Vaughn than Millar in that. This one is the first one that I can remember where it feels tampered with, beginning with the marketing and the studio jumping in on that, as well as, well, I get to the other things as we get into the film, but this one, this is a more compromised film than last week's film, and I could definitely feel it as I was watching it.
I wouldn't say compromised. I have some other adjectives I want to use. But as far as this one, definitely feels more studio-driven. Mm-hmm. For one thing, looking at the people that they brought in, it kind of reminds me of when Sony got really involved in Spider-Man 3, and that kind of burned out Sam Raimi. It led to that franchise being tossed aside, which I think Spider-Man 4 is one of the most curious, like, what-if-that-got-made movies that we've had in the genre. So this kind of felt like
a similar. I can't wait to discuss Spider-Man for that. There's so much to discuss there.
But yeah, and this one is much more, and I say this literally and figuratively, Americanized. Because you're bringing in, you know, the American counterparts based on the marketing, but also your big names now are the American actors.
Well, we get a lot of...
That's a big change for something that really felt like a Bond take and spoof and everything else, and that was a big part of it. And I think that's where you get a budget that suddenly goes to $100 million. I think it's, you play much more for your American audiences, where the first one was so British through and through.
Well, and you run into the same problems as you did when we talked to Kick-Ass 2, where when you parody a genre, where do you go with the sequel? And that was a real curiosity of me going in is, you know, they did such a good job of not only parodying the Bond franchise, but also legitimately making a good story with interesting characters. Where do you take it from there? And I was wondering how Vaughn was going to juggle that.
That's the thing. You could take it anywhere. You have a whole world that you've established that you can do whatever you want in. And when the marketing, the trailer started coming out, I'm like, okay, this kind of looks like more of the same. We knew the plot was about a drug dealer just based on the synopsis that came out. But I just really resented bringing Colin Firth back because I felt like it removes a lot of the consequence of the first movie just by doing that. Definitely. Or even insinuating that you're going to do that.
You moved backwards that way. You regressed, and you're literally only one sequel. If you bring him back, do it for film number 4.
When you run out of tropes, you might as well have had his evil if you were going to bring the actor back. Like, that's what you do as your last case scenario when you're really running out of options.
Well, you teased that last week. I had no idea how they're going to bring him back. And you actually said there's a possibility it's actually as a twin brother. So I was thinking that was going to be the twist in this. Spoiler alert, it's not. But I hate you for planting that seed in my brain there, Matt.
Well, that was my thought when this was coming through, because I'm like, okay, it's pretty definitive that he's dead. The only thing I was thinking in my head were two things. One, twin brother slash clone, which I definitely would have resented. And number two, he fired a blank, and it was all it was like a staged assassination, which also would have been dumb, but I could have seen them working around that.
That would have been really dumb. Why would Valentine stage a death? That makes no sense.
Or he thought he killed him, but someone swapped out the ammo. I knew they were going to have to do some maneuvering in order to make me like this. Because like I said, they did this exact same thing in Men in Black 2. It's the same thing of we get rid of the mentor to allow the young upstart to grow and be their own leading person. And then the minute they bring the mentor back, he reverts back to being the smarmy sidekick in a lot of ways.
Mm-hmm. I mean, look, you set him up there for a reason, to set up your lead. And by taking him away, you just decided, maybe we don't trust in our lead quite as much as we thought. It undercuts the person that you put in that role. I think it's an insult to your lead to go, and we're going to push you back again.
Well, you know what? And that's a great point. I was going to bring that up too. Taron Egerton at this point had not really grown from Kingsman. He had done what? One other film?
Well, he did Robin Hood, Sing. I think he was already announced to be playing Elton John.
Okay.
He had lost out on Solo.
What is the one I'm thinking of? God damn it.
He did Eagle with Hugh Jackman. Yes.
Yeah, that was the one I was thinking of. That was like the only other one he did that I really remembered getting any sort of press. So at this point, I can see surrounding him with the similar stars that you had before. And I think the studio was thinking, this kid is not a good big enough star to hold his own. We got to bring in the other one.
I agree to a point, but I'm like, okay, as long as you still make him the lead, like, focal point where where the story, it's his trajectory, like the first one, then you justify it. But I had no clue what to expect walking in the theater. And while this one, it made basically the same amount of money the first one did. They didn't make as much because the budget was bigger. So the first one made $414, this one made $410, almost identical. And this one was a September release versus a February one. And I think one of the things that hurt it is Stephen King's It came out a couple weeks before this. And that made, it was the high, I think it was like the highest grossing R-rated movie at the time.
I think it grossed $1 billion, didn't it?
Yep.
No, it didn't, but it says it was the third highest grossing R film at the time of its release, and it's technically the highest grossing horror film ever made. So that was still playing, but I thought this filled the niche. But unlike when the first one came out, there was no other spy movies to kind of put you in the mood, so to speak. And comic book movies, let's see, 2017, we had what? Logan, Spider-Man Homecoming, Wonder Woman.
Comic book movies were still a thing. I mean, they were still doing their thing.
There was a variety. You know, Wonder Woman was a female-led. Logan had the finality and the Western aspect. This one has the spy thing to fall back on. So I don't think it was yet at the point where we were experiencing fatigue. But when you see a movie that's 2 hours and 20 minutes, I guess fatigue is the right word.
Usually it is for me.
Well, let's. Were you going to discuss what it originally was?
Yeah, there's a four-hour cut.
I heard they said it was about 3 hours, 40 minutes, which I did read that Matthew Vaughn said this is the hardest script he's ever had to write. And by the time they were done filming it, like he said, he turned in a cut that was, could you imagine 3 hours and 40 minutes of this?
I certainly can, because this one is really trying to do the, put the bigger aspect in a sequel. But it is very much a sequel to get into the movie, which surprised me. Even though it takes place a year later, we start with wrapping in not just Eggsy, where he's leaving the Kingsmen, but the guy from the first movie shows up.
Yeah.
So this is the weird thing about this movie that starts right out of the gate. Sometimes it's really good about following up trends or items that the first movie left out. And then there's other times where they just throw toys off the table to get rid of them. I have a real complicated relationship with how this plays after having seen the first one.
Well, and then even after finding out that there's an almost four-hour cut out there, you can definitely see gaps where they had to compromise the story they were telling. And that's why I say this movie's really compromised, is a lot of the stuff that we go through with these characters, we do crazy jumps in it where you're kind of lost for a little bit. And that's not good when you're watching a spy movie like this.
You make a almost 4 hour version of a movie. It is your fault. And I've said this before when directors are, oh, I had so much movie, I didn't know what to do. Then don't write yourself a 4 hour script, you freaking idiot. You know that's not going to be made. I resent that type of screenwriting. I resent it no matter the size of the film. I do. I think it's excess that you don't let some of these kooky artists get managed, and some of them really need to be.
Well, I'm going to answer the question of why it was done right now. Matt, did they ever release a version of that movie? Did we ever see a special Blu-ray of the 3 hour, 40 minute version that they supposedly did?
There's no Snyder cut.
And it happens.
There's no cut of this. There's no extra director's cut of this. So this thing, as theatrical, is the only thing that's been released as far as this film goes.
No, I imagine there's deleted scenes on the Blu-ray.
Oh, yeah.
I don't know. Well, director's cuts aren't even a thing anymore. Kingdom of Heaven is one of the big ones, but that movie was already 3 hours long.
But that's the only reason why you would do a cut like this, is you had plans to release a special version of it, and apparently he did think that that was going to fly. Man.
This is one of the studios that used to be great for doing that.
They did it with X-Men. I mean, the Rogue cut was a big deal for Days of Future Past. They did a black and white only cut of Logan that was exclusive to home video. So maybe it was conceived at one point, but also damn near 4 hour movie that hurts your bottom line as far as the amount of theater runs and all that kind of stuff. So Charlie holds Eggsy at gunpoint, tells him to get in the cab, and because he couldn't use Let's Go Crazy in the first movie for the big church fight, he manages to use it here for this opening fight scene and chase in the car.
You know what's funny about this is I remember Prince never, ever released his music to be used anywhere. It wasn't on YouTube. It wasn't anywhere. Whoever has inherited his oeuvre, now you can get his music on YouTube, and now movies are starting to pick his music up and use them in their movies. And I gotta say, it was fun hearing this. I mean, this is a track that, like last week when we talked about Money for Nothing by Dire Straits, you definitely get a feel of the love that Vaughn has for the music of this era.
You know what's funny too is I remember this being whether it was leaked, whether it's announced, I can't remember. But I remember hearing the news that for the first time ever, one of Prince's songs has been licensed for a movie, and it's Kingsman: The Golden Circle. Because unless Prince was involved, it was just never allowed. Everything was in the vault. Go back and listen to those stories. So it was amazing that they actually found a way to make this part of the press for this movie, that they were getting a Prince song. This opening is crazy enough that, thank God, they explain, and I don't think they explain it well enough, that this is Charlie. Because if you don't pay close enough attention to what they flash on screen, you would completely miss it, because this doesn't even look like the same dude that we discussed last week.
Yeah, that's a great point. I'm so glad that the first movie was fresh in my mind going into this, because there's no way you could go into this without seeing that first film and being able to follow half the things that happened, especially in the first half of this film.
And I can raise my hand and say, somebody who saw it years later, I was confused as hell as to what's going on here in the opening until they break it down even clearer later on.
Yeah, and they give the exposition later after this fight scene. But if you're not paying attention and he recognizes him, there's a little line he says about their roles being reversed. But unless you know the first one pretty well and you wait for the debriefing scene later on, this is going to go completely over your head. So much so that he literally gets thrown out of the car. Matthew Vaughn's movies, all of them have some pretty spotty CGI. This movie is the biggest offender. It is really choppy, and some of the mergings don't look good, especially in this scene. I never feel any impact or like he's in any real danger.
Yeah, that's a great point. The visual effects in this are, you said it, they're very spotty. More so than last week. Last week I felt it was more refined, even though that movie was done 2 years before this one. I don't know if they rushed it to the point where they had to get these effects done and they had to get them done quick, but the rendering on a lot of these scenes, especially in this car when he's driving around in this, it's really, really spotty.
When I saw it in theaters, I wasn't taken out by the CG assistants, by all that. Still got the choppy editing. That's done okay. That's his style. I was not taken out of it back then that I remember. It takes me out of it watching it now. So maybe it's just a couple years. Maybe it's seeing it on a clearer screen at home than even a projection back then, but it's pretty clear where the seams are, unfortunately.
I also think on a smaller screen, you can notice some of the renderings a little bit better.
Yeah.
But he manages to, pardon the pun, disarm him completely, because he's now fitted with a mechanical arm, because now we're going into full like cyber tech with this. It's not the only time we see cybernetics and mechanical beings, but look, this is no more absurd than anything you saw in the first movie, so I'm rolling with this. I think that's a fun action scene. It's like a Bond movie where it's you start the movie on an action note.
That's exactly what I thought.
And there's a couple Bond there's a couple Bond movies where the cold open actually ties into the movie or is a follow-up to the previous film, so this at least tracks for that. And we even get a homage to The Spy Who Loved Me with the car that turns into a submarine.
Couldn't remember which Bond movie it was, but I did remember a Bond movie having that.
Yeah, I think we're the first one you get sort of allusions. I think he's full-blown putting it on Front Street for this entire opening sequence of saying, I'm going to make a Bond Kingsman intro. And I'll tip my hat to him because he does. He absolutely does it. The car chase, even the overhead view, it really, really feels Bond.
And I love the the drifting that he does when he's driving the car sideways. Like, this is all fun stuff. Even though I'm not as into it, given the special effects that aren't as special as they were last week, I am into the scene. I like Taron Egerton again this week. I am enjoying this chase, and I really, really like when he's drifting and he's going sideways as he's trying to escape Charlie.
And as soon as we get Merlin, he's complaining. What do you want me to do? He's like, you're Kingsman. Hold your breath. Figure it out. I will give it.
Yeah, like, nice callback to last week.
Yep.
Yeah. He's like, I'll guide you. I'll turn the. He's like Alfred. I'll turn on the street lights so you can pass through. Mm-hmm. But after that, you're on your own. Because he's fully his cue for all intents and purposes. Definitely. For this. Which I also have questions about the standing in Kingsman as we get into the movie. But he manages to escape Charlie. He submerges, arrives in a station. He tells Merlin that I have a date to go to, and I'm going to be in literally deep shit if I don't take it. So he says, all right, exits that way, and he willingly jumps. He pulls a Shawshank and willingly jumps into the sewer line.
Yep. And again, this is Vaughn's humor, the scatological stuff. This is all stuff that he has established in every one of his American-made films. And so, yeah, it's more of the same here.
And he goes home, and one of the things that this movie does that the Bond franchise almost never did, with a handful of exceptions, they keep the love interest from the previous movie.
I thought for sure they were going to on Her Majesty's Secret Service this chick, which they eventually do. As Adam likes to say a lot, you could definitely see the sparrows flying overhead the second she appeared on screen.
Well, I was referring to his girlfriend, not his.
Oh, okay.
Not the one that beat him in the competition. But you're right. Both of them come back, and one of them does get. Something happens that made me very upset. And depending on which cut of you saw of the first one, he fully completed an entry at the end of the first movie. He's fully with her, and this is the thing. What does a spy do if they're in a serious relationship? So I thought this was something that the movie could really add a new layer and kind of do something that very few other ones. Because Mission Impossible, they do this, but I've never given a shit about Ethan Hunt as a character.
What I like is that she knows. They take away him hiding it from her because he rescues her in the first one. So you get to play a little bit with it, but it's kind of the, might as well make Garrett's eyes roll here, but it's the Kevin Smith script for Superman Lives. It's taken away the Superman Lois by letting them know their secret identity right away. You don't have to play that game throughout this film.
Well, that's why Marvel has not done secret identities basically since their existence with the MCU, not Marvel Comics. But yeah, that's a good point. I also like that he's still very much the same guy he always was. Like, he still hangs out with his friends.
Yep. He only brought back one of his friends.
Yeah, they do the Harry Potter thing. Yeah. They recast Malfoy's sidekicks thinking nobody wants.
But he still dresses like he's Justin Bieber in 2012. I mean, was it still the way to dress? Maybe it is in England in 2017, but Jesus criminy.
You know what, Adam? You bring up a good point. I do remember there being some kind of clothing tie-in with Kingsman during the first film. Didn't they release a whole line of clothing or something?
They had Kingsman suits.
That's what
Kingsman
I thought.
Kingsman-branded suits.
Okay.
And I looked into them. They were more expensive. I thought it would be kind of cool. But they did a Kingsman line of men's suits for this. Yep.
Okay. Did they do Statesman Liquor as well for this?
Not that I found, and I looked, because I love specialty tie-in liquors that they do. Hellboy Fireball Whiskey. I was looking for it, and I never found it.
Because they do a lot of whiskey drinking in this. I mean, they did some last week, too, but here we see someone legitimately get drunk off it. So I was just wondering if they actually did do that, because that's, again, another Bond thing, right? He drinks a lot of liquor in his films.
Yeah, except when they had Daniel Craig drinking Coke Zero. I'm like, what the fuck?
Well, yeah.
Then they turned it to that in Heineken. Bond. God. Bond would not drink a Heine, everybody.
We discussed that when we discussed that film.
Yeah. But yeah, he still dresses like he's 17, even though Taron Egerton 30 at this point, or pushing 30. But he still looks young enough to pull it off. This is not a Grease situation.
Bringing up Grease again.
And then we cut to Colombia. The jungles of South America, where... All right. So in the first movie, they really lean into the Bond trope of the secret lair. And it's very techy, but it's also a bunker, so it's not that ridiculous for a tech mogul to have it. What is up with... They never explain the 50s aesthetic. It's just, let's do it because it looks cool.
And because our villain has nostalgia for that era. That's literally the only reason they give.
So you're seeing like a jungle that's been filled in, and then it's gated. There's a diner, there's a movie theater. And we cut to our main villain of the movie, Poppy, played by Julianne Moore, who is interrogating a couple of guys. And I say interrogating in quotes because she does an awful lot of smiling in this movie.
A lot of smiling. And of course, we're seeing Chekhov's meat grinder here as well.
So I love the casting. I think Julianne Moore is one of our best actresses. I mentioned this several times, how much I love her and things like Hunger Games, Carrie. I just feel like they don't give her anything interesting to do.
I feel that she always plays it at the same level, and I think that's where it's a disservice because of the talent that she has. Agreed. I think she's fun. Do I crush on her? Absolutely. Always have. But I think she's an amazing talent, but she brings it at a level, and she never deviates from it. She plays the same version of Poppy from the beginning to the end. She's menacing, but you never get a hint of evil out of her, other than just in what she does.
It's also the problem of the Santa newscast later on that she has like severe mental issues. So we should see her have some kind of breakdown in this movie, and it never happens. To your point, she's just even keeled throughout the entire thing.
Well, there's a couple big issues here. I really don't like this villain for a big reason. While I didn't like the casting of Samuel L. Jackson last week, I enjoyed that villain's plot because it's a legitimate plot. If you get your mind in a deranged enough state, you can actually see the logic in it. I see absolutely zero logic with Poppy's plot. We are going to the 80s with Say No to Drugs, and for some reason she has a stranglehold on the drug community, yet she's going to kill her customers by poisoning the drugs. This villain, and I also have a big problem with villains in these movies that stay in one fucking place. This is seriously, this chick does absolutely nothing this entire movie except, like you said, smile at the fucking camera. This is a terrible villain.
villain, and I cannot believe that Matthew Vaughn went this route with this. Your movie is only as good as your villain. This villain sucks.
Yeah, this kind of reminds me, all right, to use the Bond analogy, it's like when they got Jonathan Pryce, where it's like, you've got a great actor, what you wrote for them is terrible. And there's also a reason why what I think the worst Bond movie is him just fighting a drug dealer, License to Kill. Now, this plot worked in Live and Let Die, where Yaphet Kotto's character was getting people hooked up on drugs so he could jank the price up. He was also the distributor because his country was smuggling drugs. That was a lot more intricately done. But you're right. If this is a... First of all, Kingsman 2 is not the movie to make a statement about the war on drugs. I don't know what Matthew Vaughn was thinking with this. But more importantly, if that's the message, then she should have nothing but 80s nostalgia.
Yes.
Where she should have a picture of Nancy Reagan with a slash through it, or she should be living in like the Stranger Things world. Not the 50s, when that was all about idealism and golly gee whiz and the Leave It to Beaver era in a lot of ways. So her aesthetic does not match the period that they're trying to comment on with her plan.
Yeah, and last week I mentioned that that movie gave me so much anxiety watching it. There were certain scenes, especially the mother trying to invade the bathroom where her kid is with a knife. Like, that is stuff we had a lot of fun with last week's movie, but that stuff was legitimately terrifying. There's nothing like that here. I got zero anxiety while watching this. I didn't care about this chick's plot, and everything surrounding it really made me turn my head, and I felt Matthew Vaughn trying to top himself. I felt him in the writer's room just kind of thinking, goddamn, the first Kingsman did so well. What do people remember from it? Well, they remember the church scene. He tries to top himself with this. This isn't going to be a 2-hour slashing of this movie, but I gotta say, when I saw the plot right away and I saw this chick put this guy through this grinder, I'm like, oh god, I'm not liking where this is going. Spoiler alert, again, I'm not going to tear this film a new one in that respect throughout this entire review. There are a lot of parts of this I do actually like. This I don't.
Yeah, and as you mentioned, she initiates the guy by making him kill the other person. She's got two robotic dogs, Benny and Jet. More on that shortly. And they also, as you mentioned, the meat grinder, they use it twice. Yes. In the movie. It's like they're treading their tires in their own movie. As much as I don't like this aesthetic, there's a lot you could do. Mm-hmm. And this is the period where I started to notice Matthew Vaughn. One trick pony is slight. It's not that bad. But he uses the same bag of tricks multiple times.
Yes.
And you're really starting to see that in this movie. So she tells him to get a makeover, and instead of everyone getting Spectre rings, she literally makes them get golden circles that are carved into them with 24 karat gold, because everyone needs a gimmick. But you know what? I like this as an aesthetic.
I do too.
This makes me laugh because this is very Bond villain. This is something somebody would notice, and that's how you would get to your villain. So it, yeah.
And then watching it the first time, I was trying to think, why does she go after the Kingsmen? The Kingsmen have absolutely nothing to do with this plot. The reason why she does is because of Charlie. Charlie is her into that, and she thought, well, if I could get to him, I can actually get one of my main arch rivals out of the way. I finally put it together after the second viewing, but again, if you have a 3.5-hour cut, you can pad that out more, and well, you have to kind of pay attention to get it when you watch the theatrical cut.
Yeah, and to your point, so she mentions that the Kingsmen are an obstacle. Charlie's arm hacks into their surveillance inside the car. And then we cut to an actual Kingsmen meeting. So they're still operating, and now their leader is Dumbledore for a brief cameo.
Yeah, brief cameo.
And there's still the new Lancelot. I forget the character's name. Not that she's in this long enough to matter, unfortunately. And Merlin gives all the background about Charlie. Now, as I said, some of the continuity is really good, where they come up with the thing that because he tased him, that short-circuited the implant that would have blown his head off. So that explains how he survived. I'm like, okay, that's actually pretty clever. And it's also the thing of, you should have killed me when you had the chance, which I love that trope.
I do too.
More often than not, especially in spy movies. Mm-hmm. I don't understand, though, how that severs his vocal cords. And they mention that several times, but it's not like he's talking with a voice box, or he doesn't sound like Bane. He just sounds normal.
The opening sequence, whatever Eggsy did, needed to do something that was a thorn in the side to Poppy. And the result of that needed to injure Poppy, needed to injure Charlie, and that's why this happens. Poppy just focused all their attention on her with this move. We have no knowledge that Kingsman has ever given a shit about the Golden Circle until she brings the fight to them.
It's only out of convenience because he happens to be working for her.
And there's just no reason for this. It could have been cut, but you know what? Then write it better. And to me, that's all it is. That opening sequence, Kingsman could have done something to stumble into a Golden Circle and Charlie was already working for it. That's all you needed to do.
Yeah, you have him infiltrate something that's already ongoing and he notices he's there. It's the Jaws problem of, you bring him back just because you didn't kill him off, but he's working for another villain, but they don't explain why.
I mean, this is Spectre level of writing, and I do not mean that in a good way.
Well, this definitely has some... There are certain Bond traits in this movie that I think they took the wrong lessons from certain entities of what made Bond work. Because this one, as you guys mentioned, this one's much more of a blatant tribute to Bond. Part of that is because you literally cast a Bond girl as the American Q, which we'll talk about. But Eggsy's getting ready for a date with her parents, who are royalty in Sweden. But I like they do the classic 80s teenager thing of he's getting all the info fed by Roxy through the earpiece.
Yeah, it's the Cyrano de Bergerac thing, right? I like this as well. I gotta say, when it comes to this movie, I really dug how Vaughn treated the characters. You get character scenes like this, I am really into this movie. And this was a fun scene, I agree with you.
I'm right there as well. And what I think is overlooked, you have Eggsy and Roxy, right? What is the obvious thing to do? Of course, they hook up after it. They went through everything. He got to come back after saving the world, and he gets to put it in Ross, if you watch the uncut version of that first film.
Which we forgot to mention last week.
Yeah. So what do you do in this one? Of course, he hooks up with Roxy. I love that she's just a friend, that they are friends going through this together that work with Kingsman. I think is fucking awesome.
Yeah, it's strictly platonic co-workers.
Yeah, you never do that. And they actually have some pretty damn good chemistry, even when they're just bouncing back and forth over an earpiece.
Having said that, if you recall our Alien 3 show, I railed pretty heavily against bridging Newt and Hicks early on in the movie. And this is almost as bad in my estimation, because they spent all that time developing her. She was his equal, in a lot of ways technically his superior, because she...
Yeah, she won.
Mm-hmm.
And she just gets taken off the table just because. Why couldn't she have gone along with Eggsy and Merlin?
They wanted to start over. They literally blew the whole thing up. They take out JB too, which fucking pissed me off.
Yeah, and his friend that was watching his apartment.
Yeah.
Again, you got conveniences, and it's best not to think about them, but does that mean that they launched the missiles? The only reason the one went to his house is because his buddy... I mean, how great of a super agent are you if you're fucking... crack-smoking best friend can just, like, walk into your secret room and open up your spy equipment?
That's a great point. I didn't think about that.
He's a really lousy super agent when you think about that.
Yeah.
So if he didn't open or put on the glasses at that time, which, fun little scene that he's seen what Eggsy sees, but would that missile just not have launched? You got some stretches that I don't understand, and it's best to gloss over them, but that's not what we do.
And I also think this movie takes a lot of the wrong lessons, ironically, from Kick-Ass 2, where the female characters get treated like shit in this.
Mm-hmm. I think they acknowledge it a little bit with the character we'll get here in a little bit. I think it's at least starting to be self-referential that the genre treats women this way.
There is with one character, but there's three others that I dispute their utilization. Starting right here, where they just they blow her to smithereens and the dog. So I have to relive John Wick again.
Which, if this movie, how great would it be if this was nothing but a revenge movie for JB that it pivoted at that point?
Honestly, that would have been a more interesting plot, to be totally honest. Eggsy and Merlin run into each other outside of the wreckage of the Kingsman tailor shop. Eggsy thinks Merlin was the traitor, but Merlin tells him no, it wasn't. But we got to get to the bottom of this. And I also love how Merlin is telling him, you can cry in private, but you need to compose yourself. He is very no-nonsense, proper, classic spy.
Merlin might be my favorite. And I like Mark Strong in general, but the way he is here until his end, I think, is very well handled.
I think he does. And to me, this is one of my favorite parts. It's a random line from the first movie, but when Eggsy gets pissed after the airplane stunt, you know, and he's bitching at Merlin, he's like, you come here and you say it to my ear. And he's got that same no-nonsense here, you know, where he's just like, look, we got a job to do, man up, go fucking do it. Strong is a great actor, still looking for that perfect spot. Thanks, Ryan Reynolds. He's just he's great in so many things.
Well, if Green Lantern wasn't a steaming pile of shit, he was the perfect choice for Sinestro, which we'll talk about 20 years from now. So they survive the attack, and they say, we need to activate the Doomsday Protocol, which I'm pretty sure I heard. I was thinking of Ghost Protocol from Mission Impossible.
Yeah, I was thinking of that too.
I mean, it's basically the same thing.
Yeah, it is, where they have to go underground. Literally, they go to a wine distillery. They get a tasting room. What starts out as one drink leads to where we've all been, where you start crying after you've had a little bit. But the fact that it's Merlin of all characters makes this hysterical.
I agree. Yeah, Matt, I think you and I have had conversations like this when we were in Chicago together. Yeah, this is fun. I'm enjoying seeing these two just kind of drink to their comrades and then just keep getting more and more sloshed as it keeps going.
And they get so sloshed that they basically finish the bottle, which leads them to discover there is a message on the bourbon that leads them to the Statesman Distillery, which is the American version of the Kingsman, where instead of a tailor shop, it's a whiskey distillery. And this is where British takedown of America is always, we're just a bunch of tobacco-chewing rednecks.
Matt, I am so glad you said that, because that was going to be my very next note. Is this what the British think of us? I get it. We're going to be teaming up with this group, and I get it. You got to bring it somewhere. But is it really this Southern fucking stereotype? This is exactly what he thinks of how we are. If you're going to do this, have the Americans be legitimate as well. This is such a fucking terrible stereotype. I could not believe they got pretty much every single one in this section of film.
I feel like this is almost like Austin Powers payback.
I mean, they might as well call us subjects.
Exactly.
But they infiltrate the distillery and are interrogated by Agent Tequila, played by Channing Tatum, who was heavily marketed as being in the movie. But if you went to this movie expecting Channing Tatum, you're going to be sorely disappointed.
Yeah, they pretty much Odin him up by the end of this film, where he's disappeared because of contractual obligations to another project. But when he's on screen, I have fun with him. I enjoy his character, but he's not on screen enough for us to really enjoy him. That's my problem with him.
Well, the problem is there's no reason why him and Pedro Pascal couldn't be merged into one character.
Yeah, that's a good point, too.
Who we'll meet a little bit later on.
This is the part I was worried about, because when I saw that we were going to now just basically create another group that was the same thing, but it was American, I'm like, ugh. I'm rolling my eyes, and I don't need it. However, I got to say, it's kind of fun. And even Channing Tatum, who I don't like. I think he's as bland as could be.
Watch Blink Twice, dude. He is legit terrifying in that film.
Watch Foxcatcher. That'll turn
that
you
too.
Around.
Yeah, he's good in that too.
And what? I'll watch G.I. Joe.
Well, that's why you're going to hate him.
Yeah. That's why I hated him for so long, because I thought that's all he could do.
Yeah, he's stretched himself out pretty well in the last 5 or 6 years. I think you would dig the two films that me and Matt mentioned.
But I find that when he brings it in and he's slack jaw, jack jawing with him and everything else, I think he's having fun and I have a fun right along with him. And he wins me over amazingly quickly.
I think he has a knack for comedy, especially with the Jump Street movies. I think he's got very good comedic timing. Mm. But like I said, he's barely in this movie. And there's a shot later on where he's dancing. Well, clearly he's not in that hallway. The Golden Circle were the second unit doing the reshoots. And they get interrogated and, you know, they're saying that, how'd you know where we are? And then they, much like the first one, we have a see-through mirror that you see in police stations. And we find out that Harry is indeed alive. And all it cost him was his eye. And his memory.
If only this was a surprise. But this is the exact shot they show in the trailer.
Yeah, this is the stinger in the trailer. But it would have been the same way that when Darth Maul showed up in Solo, where you applaud because you're surprised, and you're like, wait, that makes no sense.
Well, at least they waited 6 films to bring him back. They didn't even wait a full film to bring Colin Firth back. And look, I like seeing Firth in anything. I liked seeing him back. Did they bring Sam Jackson back for this?
No, this was...
So they just merged shots.
Yeah, they just composed a new shot.
They showed the coverage, that was all.
So they reveal that Halle Berry's character of Ginger Ale, who is the Mark Strong equivalent. So on the one hand, it's clever that they were investigating the church massacre because they picked up the spikes in frequency. But I don't like that they just use like synthetic gel to bring him back to life, even though he got shot in the goddamn head. Like, that's just all brain activity, period.
Nanotech. We literally just went back to G.I. Joe, everybody. Nanobites.
And they're going to do it again, too. This is kind of Chekhov's gel.
There's no excuse that white characters should be dying if you can just heal gunshot wounds to the head.
This wasn't somebody bleeding out on a street. This was a headshot. And remember, it's not that kind of movie. You know what? You just made it that kind of movie. And that's where I get pissed. I'm like, you just completely undercut yourself by doing this.
Yeah. It does the first movie a disservice. And it also, from here on out, Taron Egerton takes a backseat because he becomes the character he was in the first movie. And the amnesia thing, it's literally what they did in Men in Black 2, where they have to re-trigger Tommy Lee Jones's memory.
My God, they did this throughout all the 80s and 90s on soap operas. This is a trope that spy movies never really did. And all of a sudden, we're having this character I had a lot of respect for last week, go through an amnesia thing as he's a butterfly expert or whatever the hell they say he is.
Yeah, Letropolis or whatever. It's a term for it. But they also never explain, okay, why is his amnesia cause him to perceive himself that way? Yeah, I'm happy this because I like the actor, but I just think it's a poor retcon.
They spend a lot of this movie trying to get him back to quote-unquote how he was. I think they spend too much time with this. If you're going to bring him back, put him in the action. Don't bring him back and then just have him kind of go through this whole plot of him seeing butterflies the whole fucking movie.
Well, there's three false starts where they try to jog his memory and it doesn't work. And then when he gets his memory back, it's treated as a MacGuffin to explain why he does certain things later on with him not being 100%.
Yeah.
So I think this is just a bad case of poor writing and a retcon that's not for the better. I mean, you can have people survive ridiculous things, but the first movie had that sense of unpredictability to it. And I feel like this movie doesn't have that, and it also doesn't have that harsh dose of reality. This one is cartoonish to a fault.
This does not feel like the same writing team from last week, and that's why I say this movie's been highly compromised, and it might have something to do with a lot of stuff that was taken out as well.
I mean, if you're asking me, I wouldn't have brought him back at all, but that's just me.
We had a shot of his dog earlier. Like, that was a legit heart-wrenching reminder of who he was. And now, we're legitimately bringing him back. You already said it, Matt, but we're taking away the power of last week's scene by doing this.
They also, like, use good new scenes of him teaching him how to use cutlery, where he's like, you know, so they shot new footage with him that works just fine. I thought that's how, if you didn't reveal in the trailers that he was coming back and you saw that, you would assume that's all he was there for, is like old new footage, but it's presented as flashbacks. But no, he survived. Somehow Palpatine survived. Although, to be fair, I don't know what's more unbelievable, getting shot in the head in a spy movie and living.
We're getting thrown down a pit.
Being thrown into the reactor of the Death Star and surviving. So they try to talk to Harry, and he tells him, like, I'm a butterfly expert, and I'm going to try and say the word. I keep forgetting what it is. I don't know who you are. They assume that the Americans did it. It's like brainwashing, but they say, no, we found him like this. And they're like, all right, so what do we do now? So they meet their version of Arthur, who is played by Jeff Bridges, who I always love to see, for all of 2 minutes that he's here.
He's not here very long.
I was convinced the first time I saw this movie, the entire time, that he was the villain behind it all. And the reason is, and I can't believe they're not smarter than this, his name is Champagne. Champ. There is no such thing as American champagne. By law, there can't be. So I thought this entire time it was a really smart way to show that he wasn't who he seemed.
Nope. That wouldn't have worked because this movie's not that clever or that subversive.
Yeah, it's too
clever. Great idea. I do like, though, that they do something similar. Ginger Ale, right? She's non-alcoholic. She's not a field agent. Merlin, he's not one of the actual knights. He's not a field agent. So I'd love that they're smart enough for that last week and a little bit this week, but there's no American champagne, everybody.
But I'm like, sometimes this movie has really good writing. Sometimes it's very flimsy and loose. And they say, all right, we've tracked Charlie's ex-girlfriend to this basically Woodstock concert, and you need to go and interrogate her. And if you have to fuck her, then by all means do it. But you're not going alone. So they get another agent played by Pedro Pascal, who's what, Jack Whiskey, something like that. And let's remember, this was before Pedro Pascal was about to become a megastar.
Yeah.
He had done Narcos, and he was on Game of Thrones, so people knew who he was, but this was kind of a launching point. I like him, I think he's fine, but there's no reason why him and Channing Tatum couldn't have been merged into one character.
Yeah, it's funny, Matt. You know, going into this podcast, I legitimately thought this was going to be another Last Jedi podcast, where as I was watching this, all these things you are saying, I have it written down almost to the note. And I'm thinking, God, I'm going to be the one who is really railing against this sequel. But you're absolutely right. There is no reason for this character to be separate from the Channing Tatum character. It's pretty much serving the same exact function. It just goes to the point that there's just too many characters here. And I'm with you. I like Pedro Pascal in this as well, but you merge this character, man, especially given where they take him towards the end of the film. But I did enjoy seeing him. I'll say that much.
Yeah, just because you signed in, just because you wrote it. Look, it's a shame, you know, that he, I guess it was because of Logan Lucky, went too long so that he wasn't available. You know what? You got choices to make. Sometimes you end up with a better Wolverine because a film shoots too long. So, yeah, I agree. Cut him out. I'd like taking him in this for the little bit we get. Like, I think he's damn enjoyable. But to sideline him the way you do just to bring in Whiskey, you do a disservice. And he's tequila. He's not even an American liquor. So it's almost like they knew what they were doing.
Yeah. And why do you have Pedro Pascal, who is Hispanic? He's not tequila.
Adam, you are dead set on these fucking alcohol names not being with the right person.
Well, these code names are like they're given for a reason. So yeah, I'm looking for meaning. I got to say, I'm enjoying his Burt Reynolds. If you're ever going to remake Smokey and the Bandit, though it'd be a little on the nose now, but it's fun watching him do this impression.
So I love how one of the gadgets he gets is a condom that you put on your finger.
Love the joke. Just Americans. Man, a little small, eh?
Yeah, this is Matthew Vaughn trying to outdo himself. And, you know, we had a lot of that scatological humor last week, and they go too far with one joke here in a little bit. This movie is just, it's too chock full of shit like this. I didn't laugh nearly as much this week as I did last week.
Well, they also skipped the most obvious joke they could have made, where they always joke, you know, how everything's bigger in America. Then Eggsy should be like, okay, then why do only three people work in your office? You only see like three or four field agents in this giant distillery. Where is everybody else? At least we have an excuse. Our place got blown up. Well, speaking of getting blown up, we cut back to Poppy and Charlie discussing what's happening, and she has a celebrity held hostage, which does tie into the first movie with all the celebrities that Valentine had invited. Somehow she has kidnapped Elton John, and Applause. My god.
Applause. I love this so much.
I hate it. And I know they brought him in because they offered him a chance to be in last week's film, but he read the script and didn't like it. And then after Kingsman was out and was a mega hit, of course he was like, yeah, let me come back. I want to actually go and join your sequel. I fucking hate every time he's on screen. He's just yelling fuck every 10 seconds, which is, this is probably how he is in real life anyway. And what, we're supposed to believe that Elton John wasn't a drug addict? This is so fucking stupid. He's brought here just to be Poppy's pawn, pretty much. And every time he's on screen, except for one time, which we'll get to, I fucking hate every time he shows up.
I'm sort of with Adam, where he kind of grew on me as the movie went on.
Garrett, I will agree with you that Elton John's yelling and screaming at the camera, yeah, I agree, that gets old pretty quick. But I love paying off the joke of just seeing Elton John in here.
It was well publicized, but I had forgotten how much he's in this.
He is in this a lot. I agree. I thought he was going to be here for a glorified cameo, but he's not. He's a legitimate fucking character.
More lines than Channing Tatum does.
I think this is when it's kind of, I feel like we say this a lot lately, and it's a shame, and I don't mean to, but this movie's 220, 222. And we're dealing with Poppy and Elton John cussing up a stage. Yeah, a cameo would have been enough. And I like seeing him here, but I'm like, move this along.
It's that whole thing of like, okay, you have one joke, just him looking at the camera and saying, fuck. That's all you have until later on in the movie. But we'll save that for a little bit. So then we cut to the music festival, and Whiskey's trying to put the moves on Charlie's ex-girlfriend, but he doesn't work. So Eggsy gives it a shot, and he manages to get in her tent, but he can't bring himself to do it. But because of, even though he has the best of intentions, says no, his girlfriend still becomes that bratty. They turn her into a bitch like they did with the love interest of Kick-Ass 2.
Yeah, they do. I thought of Kick-Ass. Yeah. I had flashbacks to Kick-Ass 2 while watching this.
I mean, no reason, especially when he says he's not gonna. It's just not. Yeah, the ending of this doesn't. It's just a way to create some artificial drama throughout the rest of this film. I love the joke that inside these tents are giant thrones and toilets and all this stuff, because this is what Glasbury and, you know, some of the ridiculous stuff at Burning Man gets to be like. I'm cracking up at that. But
yeah.
The end of this with the girlfriend is just, it's unfortunate, and it's another disservice to another woman in this type of film.
Yeah, I have been to Burning Man once. I've been to Coachella a number of times. I went to Coachella in the mid-2000s. I went to about two of those. And of course, those festivals have really changed in the last 20 years or so I haven't bothered going back. Problem is, this movie is feeling like in the later years at those of those festivals, of people coming in and basically showing off their new clothes on their TikTok accounts, I'm feeling bored. And that's how these festivals are now, is boring.
Yep. So he does implant the tracking device, but he doesn't go all the way.
Okay. Ow. So this is when they go a little too far.
Go ahead.
Apparently Taron Egerton was really uncomfortable with this. Really didn't want to
I'm
do this.
With this.
Yeah.
Well, you know the theory why, right? Like people joked about.
What's that?
People have thought he's been closeted for a long time. They think he's gay.
Really?
In real life.
Egerton?
Yeah.
Wow. Well.
If so, call me.
Wow. I was uncomfortable with this too, and I think that's exactly what Vaughn's going for, but it's not, I don't feel any of the impact of last week's film at all while watching this. So I guess Taron Egerton, what they do, they brought this actress's husband to actually do this shot, but if you're going to do this, why not just CGI it? It seems like everything else in this fucking movie is CGI.
Yeah, or have like a him like use a little robot or something. There's ways you could have done this if you were that uncomfortable.
Yeah, I'm not uncomfortable in laughing. There's an uncomfortableness that can be funny, and all that. I'm uncomfortable feeling dirty and like I need to go refill my popcorn and walk out. Like this is
why I don't like Back to the Future, because of the insinuations of potential incest.
Well, we'll get there when we get there, but we haven't even said exactly what happens here. He pretty much implants a nanomachine in her panties and her...
He puts the condom on her finger. That finger gets used to put the tracking device inside.
Tracking device, yeah.
It looks like it looks like
put it on a carrot.
Yeah, it looks like the old CSI shot when you go inside a body. So it's inserted into her shaved areas.
You might as well put it on a carrot.
I'm not explaining that joke in the other way. Well, speaking of going on mute, this is when we start to realize that Poppy's drugs cause some pretty bad side effects. Because so this is how they write Channing Tatum around the movie. He has like blue veins on his face, so they put him into cryo sleep. And Poppy does a broadcast where she says that laced all of her drugs with a toxin that causes people to develop veins, hysteria, dancing, and then their eyes explode and they bleed out. So she says, I want the president to end the war on drugs and give her immunity. And again, I don't know if Kingsman 2 is also the place where you want to do a Trump allegory.
Well, you know what this felt like? This felt like Vaughn bringing in Ronald Reagan. Bruce Greenwood here feels like he's playing Ronald Reagan, especially with the war on drugs thing that they have going on as well. And again, I'm going to bring it up. So she wants to end the war on drugs by killing off her customers. Okay. But how much money is she having to spend to get all these fucking drones to drop the antidote off if it even happens? Like, this is all the worst plot. Like, even those Bond movies, as ridiculous as those plots could have been, even with Toronto Never Dies, there's a little bit of legitimacy there. This has zero legitimacy. And I'm just, guys, I'm almost tapped out of the movie at this point. This is beyond stupid.
It's funny to me just because the legalization of weed just takes away so much of the punch of this film. I do feel it's very Reagan. It cracks me up that I was reading an interview with Vaughn that they were going to make this Oval Office so much more gold and really put a lot of Trump's lines into him. And it's like, he's not going to fucking win. And it's just going to seem that we missed a step. And then Trump won. He's like, Jesus Christ, we missed our boat. But Greenwood is still so, so Trumpian in the way he does all this.
Well, I was thinking more Nixon than Reagan.
To me, it's the war on drugs. You do everything but put Nancy Reagan here on screen.
Well, they kind of do. His secretary might as well be Nancy Reagan.
The way she looks, yeah.
Except she partakes, as we find out. So the president decides to quarantine everyone affected and just saying, let them all burn because it's a win-win. Get rid of all the drug users, the murderers, the rapists, as Trump would call them, and put her out of business permanently, which they also mention on... I mean, there's so much Fox News in this movie, it might as well be sponsored by the RNC.
That blew me away that they either don't understand the joke... that they are so stupid that they're being made fun of here, or they just don't care and they took the check. Because you got actual Fox News being used on screen and Fox News hosts that are delivering this news.
Mm-hmm. I think it's a mix of both. And I also think this is what happens when you hire foreign filmmakers to satirize American politics without fully understanding the state of American politics.
Yeah. Most American filmmakers don't understand politics. So if you have Matthew Vaughn, who I've seen him in interviews, I've seen the guy talk. He's actually a very bright guy. He's a very smart guy. But him doing this, you're right. He looks like he is going with generalizations of how American politics and how American society works.
I do think, though, that at the time that this would have started to be written and then shot, I don't know if anybody could have predicted what would have happened in 2016.
No.
I do think, even in hindsight being 2020 or 2024, I do think it casts a golden shadow for what happens. Oh my God, golden circle, golden, oh my God, it's gold. Nice. Holy crap, golden escalator. God damn everything. Oh, fuck. God damn him.
So they track Charlie's girlfriend Clara to the antidote facility in the mountains of Italy. Speaking of Spectre, this is where they fucking shot Spectre.
Well, right here in Italy?
I believe how much this turns into a Bond scene.
When he goes to see Lea Seydoux in her office in the Alps.
Oh, okay.
And they have that big chase with the plane. I mean, this is pretty similar geography, and that was the most recent Bond movie. Yeah, it was 2 years before this, but still.
Yeah.
And before they go, they have to break Harry's amnesia, so they threaten to shoot a dog, which I guess this would be the thing that is traumatic enough to snap him out of it. Although there's that, this is still that period where we de-aged people and it never looked 100% right.
Mm-hmm.
They look like almost like their skin is made out of plastic.
Yeah.
It doesn't work because you played this beat last film, though, about shooting the dog.
No, it does work. I think this is what you do to get him out of this, because this is traumatic. This is just traumatic enough to work. So I do like them bringing this back in order to have him wake the fuck up.
I get that it would work. I don't need it again, especially since we saw this dog up on the... I don't know.
Well, I like that this tracks, but this should also be the first thing they thought of. Knowing him as well as they did and how close he was to that dog... And also, Eggsy realizing that was the thing that I could not do, and I'm still screwed up by it, and I just lost my dog.
I like the build-up to it, though. It has to come to them eventually. See, them doing it immediately makes them look too smart, so I had no problems with this. I actually kind of liked it.
Well, I also wanted them to snap out of this sooner, especially because I feel like this movie is too long as it is.
Much too long.
So they snap him out, but they realize they do the repeat thing of in the bar where he locks the door, but he can't fight as well as he used to because his reflexes aren't fully adjusted, but Whiskey's there to take them all out with his Indiana Jones whip. Not the only one he has, by the way.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
But this is doing the thing I don't like in sequels, where we're just repeating the iconic scenes from the first one.
We think we're going to get it repeated, but we don't. I like the little bit of a twist that he puts on it. Again, this is another thing. I had no problems with this scene either. I actually enjoyed this introduction of Whiskey fighting.
It's a twist I like because he said the same thing, locking the door,
yeah,
that's even in that first trailer. I do like the changes. It goes on a little much. I think it's important that we see what Pedro Pascal could do,
mm-hmm,
just because it sets up later. But again, I do think this movie's got a stop and start problem. It's just, it can't keep the clutch down and the car going. Sorry, for those that Google clutch, kids. it's sputtering along.
And also, they don't understand the physics of a whip, because in some scenes, it's strong enough to throw a chair across the room, and then there's other parts where it looks like it has no weight behind it at all.
They don't understand the physics of a whip? Have you seen Wonder Woman?
Well, that at least...
That's a lasso, not a whip, sir.
Yeah, that's a lasso, not a bullwhip. And B, that thing was made by Zeus, so I don't care about the physics.
What I'm saying is CGI artists, in general, have a real issue with trailing a whip like this, so I didn't have any real issues with it.
That's why Indiana Jones never got an electric whip.
Exactly, yeah.
Like, he didn't get one from Aliens and Crystal Skull. He's like, I'm sticking with the OG one. But they go to the factory. I do like how Harry can't even shoot the tranquilizer dart at the guy. He just shoots it at the computer, so he has to knock him out with the fire extinguisher. Yes. And Whiskey and Eggsy get into a ski lift that gets thrown down the side of the mountain, which they're really the Pierce Brosnan Bond film, because these guys don't get hurt whatsoever.
But you know what? I love this scene. This scene was really needed. I was getting bored out of my mind at this point. We have gone almost an hour without an actual action scene. And this is glorious. This is Vaughn at his absolute best. It seems like this. It's kinetic. I love seeing them get thrown around in this lift. All of this, I was having a good time with. I liked them barely missing the top of the mountain. This is all real. You just mentioned Indiana Jones. I could see it being a little bit Indiana Jones. Of course, Bond. But I enjoyed this scene a lot. I was right back into the movie at this point.
Fun. I like these two Jack John back and forth. And tease him. Like, I think Egerton and Pascal got some pretty good chemistry, enough that I don't need Harry back. I don't need some of the other ones, but just really focus on these two.
And then when they get to the down the mountain, Harry knocks the antidote. Well, Whiskey breaks the antidote sample. Harry thinks, now this is where I talk about his amnesia / reflexes being a MacGuffin, because you don't know if he did that on purpose or not, but it's whatever the writers want to come up with when they feel like explaining it.
Well, they want you to question it along with him.
Like this, though, when Harry and Eggsy, though, were having this argument, and Whiskey runs out to fight all these guys, and he's in soft focus in the background doing this John Wick gung fu with all these fucking Spectre agents that have come down the mountain. If you're not paying attention to him in the background, you'd completely miss it.
Yeah, because he's literally taken out, and he breaks out the electric whip where he cuts a guy in half. And it's the lightsaber thing of it cauterizes instantly, so there's no blood. This is pretty cool, but again, it's also the thing of, rather than let him die, they use that stupid gel crap to keep him alive.
Yeah, we introduced this earlier, so we got to pay it off.
And Charlie does the Bond villain thing of killing off his girlfriend. He might as well drop her into a piranha tank because they blow up the factory. This way they also reveal that his girlfriend has been affected because she did drugs at some point.
Music festival.
She wasn't at the festival, though. I'm talking about the princess that he's banging.
Oh. Yeah, you see, when she gets in a fight with Eggsy, you see her smoking weed at one point. So she has a joint, but Eggsy has got friends smoking crystal meth on his couch.
You think they would run to the law at some point.
Jesus.
Or you would stop associating with that. You'd be like, hey, weed's okay, but don't let that guy into my fucking house.
Might be a little too far.
Like, crystal meth is where I draw the line. They find out where her hideout is, so they all go to Cambodia, and they get decked out with new suits, including Merlin, dressed for combat, which was the clue to me, oh, they're going to kill him off.
I like him coming out dressed in this suit. Just like, looks good, feels good, Eggsy. This is great. Opening up the pool table and doing it. I like it.
Yeah, and of course, everything's Americanized, like the baseballs are grenades.
Yep.
Which, I guess this makes sense because they have access to all of the statesman's equipment. So it's not that they had to make it, but they arrive, and he steps on a landmine, which...
Oh, Merlin does.
No, Eggsy steps on it, and he makes him switch places.
Yeah, he switches.
That's right, places. That's right.
Because he sprays it with, it's like antifreeze, so they can swap out. And I got to ask a question. In 2017, were the rights to John Denver music just public domain and people could fucking use it whenever they wanted? Because this, Alien Covenant, and Logan Lucky all use not just John Denver, but this one song.
Yeah, this one song got 3 plays in theaters in 2017. That's a great question. I have no idea. I don't know what it was about, especially when you had Elton John right there. Like, what are you guys doing?
Well, they use his music shortly.
Well, they do, but what I'm saying is, when you have him there, why not use more of it?
And this is the second John Denver song in this film. Mm-hmm. Like, how do you reuse an artist? That's crazy. But I love watching him sing this song while he's standing there. Like, I love this moment. It's fucking great.
Well, this was the only, like, emotional resonance I had in the movie when he dies.
Does he, though? We don't see a body. I think he uses, what is it, Charlie's blue suit from earlier? I don't see this them killing this character off. For this moment, it works, but when it blows up, we don't see him. So I don't legitimately believe that
he's dead. No, but you see pieces go all over the place.
But there were 6 troops right there.
Yeah, but we'll never know because this ain't getting a sequel, but I think this was meant to be definitive.
I didn't feel that at all in watching this. I think he legitimately knew if he took Eggsy's place here, he knew that he was going to be able to get away.
I don't read it that way. I read it as self-sacrifice because you can't do that beat twice in back-to-back movies.
Oh, I think they feel like they could. I don't believe he's dead.
Well, we'll never know because this ain't getting a sequel. Yeah.
I always took it that country road took him home.
If you can't sing, don't do that. Like, go out with some more dignity. And also, like, John Denver had been dead for a long time, yeah. So I don't understand why it was this year. It's not like Prince where he finally dropped dead and they're like, finally.
Right? Yeah. And it's not like he was aching to get his stuff scooped up. So, hey, no, his estate made a lot of money this year, so good for them.
I'm sure there was a lot of purple rain when that bomb went off.
Jesus.
But they basically, this is where the big fight scene is to Elton John's Saturday Night playing that. And we also find out Elton John was a Kingsman agent at one point because he takes out these other two guys with a spinning jump kick.
Yes. I did like, until that moment, I did like this fight. I liked Whiskey taking the whip and he grabs a hold of a knife with the whip and uses it. Like, this is really fun stuff. This is stuff that I expect in a Matthew Vaughn film and I'm getting in spades here.
Fun. I like because this street is set up. You set up your action box. You set up your kill box here. You know the layout. You know what's on that. I think this is played really well. This is the church scene. It's different. It's fun. We see the gadgets. It's the music. It's the quick cutting. It's enjoyable. And I think it's played a lot more fun than what we got with the church scene last week. I like this. I think this is and we needed it. We really need some fun going into the end.
Yeah. I also like how he just nonchalantly breaks Charlie's neck.
Yep.
This is where he becomes the Daniel Craig Bond of I'm not going for one-liners or snarky comebacks. I'm just going to break your neck and move on.
Mm-hmm. Total Man of Steel. Though I don't need Charlie here. I need somebody different. I hate that Charlie is actually throughout the entire course of this film.
Well, he's the villain's entry into taking on the Kingsman, so we do need him here. But you're right. I don't think we need him in this actual scene. I think he could have just hung out with Poppy in the fucking lair for all I care.
The thing is, though, Poppy's supposed to be crazy, and she values loyalty and everything else. He screwed up, like, 3 times. What we should have got was a metal arm sticking out of that meat grinder.
Or she implanted his consciousness into a robot, which she teases.
I thought,
and he's like a full-blown Terminator.
Or turn him into a burger, like we saw earlier.
It's just, like I said last week, this dude just, I don't know what it is about him. He just, this dude just rubs me wrong.
Well, good thing he didn't play Eggsy then.
So Elton John also kills one of the robotic dogs. And I do think this is Julianne Moore's best line read of, fuck you, Elton. Like,
well, my favorite Elton John moment is when we just all of a sudden see his head stick right in front of where the dog is. That is a moment that got a legitimate laugh out of me.
That giant smile he's got on his face.
Great. Yeah. That is the one moment I will give Elton John in this movie.
I do like that these dogs are Benny and Jet.
What's that supposed to be?
Benny and the Jets, Elton John song.
It's an Elton John song. The movie Marquee is The Bitch Is Back.
Yeah, I knew that.
This is Elton John all the way through.
But then she should have a 70s thing or an 80s thing, because that's when he was popular. Like,
that's exactly it. Yeah.
She should have had like Elvis frozen in carbonite and unthawed him.
Yeah, the time frame doesn't match.
What I read Vaughn say was he mentioned three or four different names that he made this a combo of. It was Florence Henderson in The Brady Bunch. It was the mom from Happy Days and Hannibal Lecter, which, of course, Matt, you and I discussed Julianne Moore's association with Hannibal Lecter when we did Hannibal those years ago. I get none of that here. This character is so goddamn inconsistent.
The character I get because, yeah, she's playing Florence Henderson. So there is no parallel for like an 80s mom, I guess. You'd end up with Roseanne, you know, somebody like that. So we need the Florence Henderson type. It just doesn't fit with the thing she loves. So that's where you get the inconsistency.
I find everything with her just really inconsistent, not just how she's written, but what she's into versus, I get it, the 50s, there's not a lot of performers who'd be alive that you could do, unless you got like Paul McCartney or something.
Yeah.
Pirates already beat that dead horse. Thankfully, she wouldn't have to endure that again. Actually, that would have been funny if they revealed after John Lennon was shot, she used that gel to bring him back to life and had a deep fake of him performing just to piss everyone off. Yeah. But they just kill her off nonchalantly. They eject her.
I hate this. I hate the way they kill her. Everything about this character is fucking stupid. What did they do? They inject her with heroin? What the fuck is this?
Yeah, it's a concentrated dose of the heroin, but the side effects are all sped up.
I hate it so much.
It's just lazy. Yeah. She deserved better.
Oh, well, speaking of lazy, Pedro Pascal just shows up and he's like, yeah, my wife was murdered by a bunch of drug dealers, so I want all the drug dealers to die.
So he's our big bad at the end, I guess.
Yeah, because you can't have them fight Julianne Moore.
And gee, how are they going to dispose of him with this meat grinder in the middle of this? I have no idea.
I gotta say, I laugh at the joke that he rides a silver bullet to get here. Like, it's just...
And as to the surprise of everyone, they throw him in the meat grinder. And then, what is it with these movies of fucking drones? Release the antidote. Like, it was every fucking movie around this period was drones in some capacity.
I mean, we kind of mentioned that this president is such a piece of shit that he takes, is it the Silver Dome?
Yeah, he takes a stadium and literally quarantines people there in, like, cages.
Yeah, what was that? That had no business being in this movie. That was weird. That belonged in, like, Minority Report or some shit.
You make it today, he would have used a drone and sent him across the border. I mean, it's where they're going with it.
Yeah, there would have been ICE agents.
It's that allegory.
Yeah, he gets arrested, impeached, because he was going to commit genocide.
Yeah, this happens this quick.
And she's like, oh yeah, I'm going to be president now, and nobody questions this, because they're like, you were his press secretary, so technically you're an accomplice, whether you were with it or not.
There is a line of succession, people.
Matthew Vaughn and Jane Goldman have zero idea of how American politics works.
Now, to be fair, if they kill the king and whoever the prince is, I don't know what the line of succession is if I was writing a British one.
Then don't fucking do it.
That's why you open a book and do your research.
Yes.
Yeah, that's true. I do know how to Google.
Yeah, just Google the fucking thing.
And the statesmen, to help the Kingsmen rebuild, they buy a Scottish distillery. Which, if there's one thing us Americans don't know how to do, is make scotch, because scotch can only be made in one of the five sections of Scotland. It's like tequila. If you make tequila in America outside of the five places in Mexico, they will sue you.
Oh, yeah.
And I thought there were going to be the joke between bourbon and whiskey because of how it...
Well, they do, because there's the joke about being spelled with with an E, depending on if your country is spelled with an E.
Mm-hmm.
And they also mentioned this is where... So they tease a little bit that Halle Berry's a field agent only because she's a woman, which I like this concept, but the problem is they got beat to the punch because in the Craig Bond films, they made Moneypenny a field agent.
Yeah, but I like this. We haven't really spoken about Halle Berry in this.
Well, she's barely in it.
She's barely in it, yeah. And you know what? It took me a few scenes of her to actually realize it was actually her. I like how she's used minimally here, because when this happens, it actually had an impact. I like the way this was done.
I think she's actually pretty dang good in it, too.
Yeah.
Like, she's enjoyable to see, and I think she's an Oscar winner, but she's in some absolute shit movies with shit performances.
Oh, she's been in here. Some dog shit the last few years. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. But I think she brings a charm to all the scenes that she's in here. She's a very pleasant present.
I just can't get Jinx out of my head. I'm like, that's too on the nose to cast a Bond girl.
Well, of course, and that's why Vaughn did it.
Yeah, and I think it's purposeful. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
You can't just put a set of glasses on her and make you forget about the fact that she was Jinx.
I'm like, oh yeah, she has a pair of glasses, so suddenly I have to buy her as
yeah. the... Yeah,
exactly. Which is funny, because you open this new distillery, and the thing to do would be to have Pierce Brosnan in charge of it.
Well, we've said that name at least two or three times the last couple weeks.
Yeah, that's the one thing I'm like, I'm surprised they didn't get a Bond actor to be in this. Mm-hmm. I mean, the person who would have been appropriate is Timothy Dalton, because he's distanced enough from Bond now. Honestly, he should have been the villain. He should have been the villain.
The villain of those movies.
They probably read the script. I think it was probably offered to them, but they said,
I think of, like, this movie needed, like, him, how he plays it, and Hot Fuzz, where you can have a comedic villain, but they actually have to be interesting. And look, I don't think this is Julianne Moore's fault. I just think it's not handled well. But it's handled well enough to where Eggsy gets married, so he becomes royal lineage in Sweden. And they send Channing Tatum. There's one thing we need is this dumbass helping out in the UK. This is like when Trump sent Woody Johnson to the UK to be the ambassador. What do you think this guy's going to accomplish? But there's no post-credit scene for this one. The movie ends with them having a new tailor shop in London.
Yeah, I fast-forwarded through the credits to see if maybe there was a post-credit scene, but nope, we don't get it.
Nope, to quote Willy Wonka, you get nothing.
Yeah.
But do you lose based on our scores of this movie? So on a scale of 1 to 10, Adam, what do you give The Golden Circle? And you can't give it a 0 because it's a circle.
Not giving this film a 0. I think it deserves more credit than that. But it deserves to be looked at in comparison to the film that we got last week, because this film had the same team going for it. Matthew Vaughn is back. He gets his team back. He gets to do his film. This film was obviously interfered with. And I'm not blaming a studio. I'm just saying that they had some stuff to do. Don't write a 4-hour film and then decide you're going to cut it down to 2.5 hours. Because at 2.5 hours or 2:20, this film is still 30 minutes too long. There's a lot going on in this film. Clunky. It's chintzy. It's the later of the Craig Bond films. I mean, this thing is Spectre without the cinematography. It's villain. I think she's a delight. I think she's fun, but she doesn't bring the menace that it really needs to. The cameos throughout are perfectly acceptable. I can't stand that Charlie gets brought back and then is listed all the way through to the end of this film, because he doesn't change at all. I like that we bring back Princess Tildy, but then I hate what we do with her. This thing is just, it's all over the map. For every time it does something right, it takes two steps backward, and that's a shame. Somebody needed to refine this script. Somebody needed to hold Matthew Vaughn down and say, dude, you got some great ideas. Stop fucking yourself up. He shoots himself in the foot over and over with this film. That said, I think Taron Egerton is still a delight to watch. I think Pedro Pascal is fun when they're Jack-Jawing back and forth together. The rest of this is not all that well done. Mark Strong, I'm going to watch him in anything he does because I like him as an actor. But this thing's a pretty far step down from last week. If it's on in the background, I leave it on. But I don't run to this film, and that's a shame because I do run to the first one. I'm giving this a 6. I think that's being pretty generous. I like some of the performances, but this is a big step down from Secret Service. 6 for The Golden Circle.
So we got a 6. I don't know where Garrett's going to fall. I feel like he has a similar score written down, but who knows? You could surprise me, which this movie fails to do, because unlike the first one, there's no genuine surprises if you ask me. But Garrett, what do you give The Golden Circle?
I'm going to keep this pretty short. This is one of those times where I was dreading the fact that the three of us never text each other while we watch one of these films for review, just so that we don't want to influence any of the others and know where the other one's coming from. Because I legitimately thought I was going to come in here, and given the fact that this movie got pretty good reviews upon release, and of course it made over $400 million, I was legitimately thinking that we were going to get another Last Jedi podcast where I would fight every step of the way. But I am pleasantly surprised that it seems like my other two colleagues kind of agree with me on this. This movie's a fucking mess. I like the action scenes. I think Vaughn is best when he does action scenes. I like the character moments from people that I really liked from last week. Now, the villain I have said my piece on, I have screamed my piece on. While I didn't like Sam Jackson's casting last week, I liked his plot. I liked how the Kingsman handled that plot. I hate everything about this fucking villain and everything around its plot. Elton John was just obnoxious. Every time he was on screen, I felt the same way I felt with the majority of this movie. It's obnoxious and it's not good. Given that I have a love for these characters from last week and he handles those moments well, I'm going with a 5. This is not only one step down, this is 2 steps down. Given that this movie had the reviews that it did, I thought I was going to really have a good time, but man, both times I watched this, I did not have a good time. And Adam's absolutely right. If you're going to make a 3.5-4 hour script, don't be pissed off if you're being forced to trim it down. This needed to be cut. Characters needed to be cut. And given what we had last week, I was legitimately disappointed in this one. So 5 out of 10 for Kingsman: The Golden Circle.
So I can summarize my thoughts on this movie pretty quickly. I guess that's why they call it the blues, because that's what I felt leaving this theater. As someone who loves the first movie, and I sincerely do, this was everything I was afraid of, what I thought it was going to be. I think much like Kick-Ass 2, it doesn't work as a tribute or a lampooning because it's already an exaggerated cartoon. And there's none of that surprise element, and there's also none of the, I don't want to say dramatic heft, because that's a bit of an exaggeration, but there's no stakes in this one. And part of that is by undoing one of the genuine surprises of the first movie by killing off your mentor character with the third act still to go. And it's a lot of tropes that I don't like. Amnesia, storytelling, I don't like how the female characters are written. That's, I mean, instead of Mark Millar, I thought Frank Miller wrote this, to be perfectly honest. I like Taron Egerton, but I don't feel like Eggsy has any kind of a legitimate journey in this movie. Like, he doesn't learn anything outside of just getting hitched. He's still the same agent he was, but he's also no longer really his own man because his mentor is still alive. And they never resolve, by the way, okay, who's going to be Galahad. The movie ends with them both still being the same coat. It's never resolved because I feel like this movie is just I feel like it's when you get shot in the head. It's a brain-dead, amnesiatic mess with too much going on. I'm going to give it a 5. This is the Dolly Parton duology, because the first one's a 9, this one's a 5. And it's and honestly, Dolly Parton might have been a better fit for this than Elton John.
Yeah, because given Dollywood and Polly, I can see that for sure.
Yeah, hell, Dolly Parton could have played Julianne Moore. I mean, they gave her the same amount of bad material.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a waste of Julianne Moore's talent, to be perfectly honest. But it's a 5. It's not awful. There's some moments I do like, but this is kind of, when I think of disappointing sequels, this is one of the ones that I think of.
Yeah, for somebody who came in screaming that we learned from Kick-Ass 2, it didn't seem like you did, because you made a lot of the same mistakes here.
Yeah, and they heard my cries because we didn't get a sequel next. We got a prequel. I thought that was already a harbinger of things to come, possibly, because that title is not exactly clever.
What was the title?
The King's Man. 2-3 words.
All right. Well, I legitimately have no idea about next week's film. We're going back to
World War I / World War II era. So the next one plays a lot with, I would pitch it sort of to give you a preview, not to like get into the spoilers. Think of it as like how Indiana Jones plays with history. It's kind of like that context where like they deal with historical figures, but they're kind of also, it's like an exaggerated type of history, alternative, if you will. But Matthew Vaughn came back. Gene Goldman did not co-write this, though. And I had no expectations for this and no desire until they cast Ralph Fiennes in the lead. And I'm like, God damn it, I have to go see it now. Because I think he, like when you think of like Kingsman, he could have very well played the Colin Firth role. And remember, he was considered for Bond way, way back. And he played M. So, of course, you get him. But I didn't care about a prequel. I kind of felt like with the second one, a lot of the magic was gone. Adam, did you feel the same way?
When I heard that they were doing another film, I was excited. When I heard that it was a prequel, I was less interested. When I was told that it was going to explore possibly, you know, the founding of the Kingsmen, I was more excited. When I learned about the time frame it was set in, I was, again, disappointed. I don't give a shit about World War I. There's so much misinformation because of how stuff was done back then. So I just, it was like this film. Every time I got excited, something else slapped me back into my place. So I was not in a rush to go see this.
And Garrett, first time viewing, obviously.
First time viewing, yeah. And like I just said, I legitimately have no idea where we're going. Given the absence of Jane Goldman, that scares me as well, because I think a lot of the heart that is in both the first Kick-Ass and the first Kingsman were because of her. This, I gotta say, guys, I have heard nothing about this. This legitimately scares me. I hope that I don't have as bad of a time with this upcoming film as I did with this one, but I don't want to say I'm dreading it, but I'm not looking forward to revisiting this property if this is how this is handled. So Matthew Vaughn's back to direct next week's film, you said?
Back and co-wrote.
And he co-wrote, okay.
But his new co-writer was the showrunner of Stranger Things Season 1 and the co-writer of Adam's favorite movie, Oblivion.
Adam's ears perked up.
When I did finally see this, I learned about as little as I could possibly before I saw the film. I did not search out information. I saw a trailer once and I left it alone until I saw it. So I went into it about as virginal as I could be.
Yeah, that'll do, pig. Until next week. So until next week, we're going to review The Kingsman. If I save the world, can I have 2 tickets to your next concert? Darling, if you save the world, you can have a podcast. Thank you, guys. I'm going to be risky.
I know what you're going to say.
I should be proud of myself because I'm finally using my gift for something important.
No, I was just going to tell you your fly was down for the whole show.
Thank you for listening to this edition of the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast, exclusively here on Percolated Media.
Congratulations. Bloody well done.
Come back every Friday as new retrospective reviews are posted weekly on your favorite podcast platform of choice.
You're right about the snobs, but there too, there are exceptions.
And if you would be so kind, please take a moment and give us a positive review and rating on your podcast platform of choice.
Pretty fucking great.
It truly helps others find and discover our podcasts.
How was that? Not so bad. Kind of fun, huh?
Check out the Percolated Media Archives, as we have tons of franchise reviews, including films of the DC Universe featuring Superman and Batman, the Incredibles movies, the Planet of the Apes franchise,
the Lethal Weapon films, the Alien franchise,
Jurassic Park, and so many more.
Okay, you cunts. Let's see what you can do now.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is produced by Garrett, Matt, Adam, and Nathan.
Words to live by, Exit. Words to live by.
The Three Men in a Retrospective podcast is edited by Garrett.
As long as your heart's in the right place, we don't care what you put in your mouth.
The Three Men and a Retrospective podcast is voice narrated by Adam.
I feel like a tornado in a trailer park.
Scheduling done by Matt.
I'm trying to figure out how to explain this without sounding like a complete idiot right now.
This podcast is not affiliated with any film studio or network, and all opinions expressed on the Three Men in a Retrospective podcast represents the opinions of that individual. Any similarities to any and all things associated with the films in question are strictly coincidental.
Playtime's over, kid.
I never play.
This podcast is for entertainment purposes, and all clips, music, and audio cues are used as such.
What the fuck are you doing here? You taking a piss?
The Freeman and a Retrospective podcast is a Percolated Media production. All rights reserved, and no copyright infringement is intended.
Really believe in all this?
I believe that when a man's chest becomes an insect's palace, when his eyes are gone and his limbs ain't there no more, when I'm so scared I want to handcuff myself to my bed to keep from coming to work, yeah, I believe it, man. I believe I don't want to die, Sheriff.
Show's over, motherfuckers.
We need to stop saying the ones that everyone else agrees with. I'm more interested in what are the ones that you like that other people don't seem to.
Well, maybe we'll make that a special Patreon show when we get that
great,
up.
Again. Yeah, that's a great sequel discussions. Mm-hmm. Or great part threes.
Yeah, ooh, or part twos for that matter.
You can count on one hand good part threes.
Well, especially in the horror genre alone.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Adam, you also had to wait. But he still looks young enough to pull it off. This is not a Grease situation.
Bringing up Grease again.
Well, that's like the golden standard, mm-hmm. if you will, of guys are clearly, or even Nightmare on Elm Street. The one that gets hung in the jail cell, he looks the least likely to be in high school.
Yeah, he looks like he went to school with Nick from Teen Wolf. Oh, that's right. You still haven't seen the first Teen Wolf film.
I'll take it. I'll get to it eventually. With all the Stephen King shit you're making me watch, I've got to not have free will until I'm on my deathbed as far as stuff to watch. And then we cut to Columbia.
I got to say, I'm enjoying his Burt Reynolds. If you're ever going to remake Smokey and the Bandit, though it'd be a little on the nose now, but it's fun watching him do this impression.
Isn't that what the new Mandalorian movie is going to be, Smokey and the Bandit?
Probably.
Who knows? Maybe you'll see that movie. So I love how one of the gadgets he gets is a... I'm sort of with Adam where it kind of grew on me as the movie went on. Because we knew Taron Egerton was doing the Elton John biopic, so I'm like, was this part of the contract?
What did we know? I'm trying to remember. I don't even think we knew at this point. Didn't that come out in, 19?
Yeah, but a little bit after a year, but that movie was in development for so long, he might have already been cast.
It's Sing had already come out.
Yeah, and he performed I'm Still Standing in that.
But it's...
Okay, so they announced Egerton was replacing Tom Hardy in July 2017.
So they wouldn't have even known Hardy until originally? This was after release. This was already released.
Possibly.
Yeah.
Yeah, we dodged a bullet with Tom Hardy not playing Elton John. Remember Elton John wanted Justin Timberlake?
Of course he did.
Elton John's a weird dude.
Yeah, he is, but... him being in this movie, it would have been one of the Golden Girls. or the mom from the Wonder Years.
Yeah.
Trying to think what else was there. Was Family Ties the 80s?
Yes, Family Ties was the 80s. It was 82 through 89, so yeah, that's straight 80s.
So, you could have found somebody.
I think she's actually pretty dang good in it, too.
Yeah.
Like, she's enjoyable to see, and I think she's an Oscar winner, but she's in some absolute shit movies with shit performances.
Oh, she's been here. In some dog shit the last few years. Oh, my God.
Oh, yeah. You ever seen Gothica?
Well.
I'll defend it.
Yeah, Adam actually likes that movie. She was in one the last, I think it was like 6 years ago. She was in The Call, which I kind of liked.
That movie sucks.
I kind of liked it. I enjoyed it.
It's really bad to go on a sidebar. You ever see Perfect Stranger with her and Bruce Willis?
No, I never did.
Where the big twist is that she's the murderer?
No.
Oh God, that you would love that movie. It's so bad.
I got to watch it now.
But I think she brings a...
And given the fact that this movie got pretty good reviews upon release, and of course it made over $400 million, I thought the two other people on this podcast... Hold on a second. Let me close that down. I was dreading the fact... I was...
So, until next week when we review The Kingsman, if I save the world, can I have two tickets to your next concert? Darling, if you save the world, you can have a podcast. Thank you, guys.
Thank you, boys. All right, take five, and we'll come back for a four-hour podcast.
No.
30 minutes.
Yep.